figured I could one day represent my parents' case. I could also become an advocate for immigrant families. But law school is such a major expense. Hello, more loans. That I wanted to first check out the industry and see if I liked it. My plan was to get certified as a paralegal, work with lawyers, and then decide whether I still wanted to apply to law school. I also took a part-time receptionist position at a law firm specializing in personal injury cases. Between that, my waitressing, and school, I was barely catching any Z's. With so much going on, there wasn't a bunch of time left over for me to see Lorraine. Even so, I fit in sessions every other week. In the first few months, I did most of the talking as she nodded and took notes. But over time, as she got a clearer sense of my issues, she began challenging much of what I told her, like this. I used to think I wanted to be a performer, I said. I'm now considering law. What made you change your mind? She asked. A career in the performing arts isn't practical for me, I told her. Why? Because it's too late, I explained. If I wanted to be in musical theater, I should have gone to a conservatory. She removed her glasses and placed them on her lap, then looked right at me. Girl, she said, do you think you're just afraid that if you went after that dream now, you'd fail at it? It may be why you set up all these roadblocks for yourself. I squirmed in my chair. What roadblocks? I said. What do you mean? I mean you get in your own way. Whether or not you're aware of it, she explained. Look at the choices you've made over the last few years. Notice how often you've gotten close to completing a goal that's important to you and then you've fallen off track. That's probably not a coincidence. I sighed and tried to wrap my brain around what she was saying. I guess so, I said. But I'm not even sure I still want to be an entertainer. Really? She said, raising her eyebrows. You light up every time you mention it. I shrugged. I don't know, I said. I may not be good enough. I may have doubted my own talent, but the girls at work thought I had a knack for performing. Every night as we got dressed, I'd break out my best material for them. I had this one spoof where I'd imitate Britney Spears dancing in the video Stronger. I would make my voice sound all like hers, wildly swinging my hair from left to right, and I'd do these insane moves all over a chair the way she does. Only I would trip over the chair and make it as unsexy as I could. My friends laughed hysterically. One day a man walked by and suggested I never do that again, because indeed it wasn't sexy. Ah, shove it, you pig, I snapped. What do you know? Die. Why aren't you trying to be an actor? Luciana would ask. What's with this law thing? You could totally be on TV. That sounded good, and I look forward to going to work so I could show off whatever new routine I could come up with. But entertaining my friends was one thing. Making a living and putting myself out there in front of the world was another matter altogether. My drinking hadn't stopped, but I had been practicing my daily affirmations, courtesy of Lorraine. Forgive yourself, Diane. Today is a new day, I'd say to myself. It's okay if you drink, as long as you can get up the next morning and accept yourself. Ha! That's right. I made up that last sentence of the affirmation so it could fit my lifestyle. That worked for the most part, except when I got terribly sad. When you fling open the closed doors of your heart, it's incredibly painful. You want to escape, and I often did. But at least I wasn't doing that as much by tearing into my skin. When you have the urge to cut, Lorraine had told me, squeeze some ice into your hand instead. Believe it or not, that worked for me. That and a little yoga, namaste, was life-changing. Be kind to yourself, Dee. I'd often have to remind myself. I still do. A session at a time, Lorraine's ideas began to stick. She was right. Most of my moves had been based on the fact that I was scared out of my mind. What if I did everything in my power to become a success only to fail miserably? What if I pursued a career in entertainment and got booed off the stage? What if people didn't like me? In many ways, I'd been tripping myself up so I'd never have to answer those questions. It's interesting what you start noticing about yourself when you pay close attention. You're allowing fear to block your greatness, Lorraine often reminded me. You've got to change your mindset. She had a point. Fear is what had kept me from applying to a conservatory, and fear was dogging the dream I claimed to no longer want. Hashtag self-sabotage. Meanwhile, week after week, I sat there at that desk job answering phones and filing documents. I absolutely hated it. I have never been more bored in my life. The minutes literally dragged by, and the whole time this whisper I'd been hearing, this nagging sense that I was meant to be doing something else, grew louder. I wasn't supposed to be sorting through legal documents. I belonged not in a courtroom, but on a stage or a set. Yet, law was the safe option, or so I thought. That's why I clung to it so hard. By then, though, I'd figured out this wasn't the road for me. Rather, it was a detour from the route I was too frightened to take. During our months together, Lorraine gave me many gifts, and one of the greatest came during a session in the summer of 2009. I was telling Lorraine, again, about all the ways I'd dropped the ball, all the stupid decisions I'd made, all the times I'd let myself and others down. Usually, she let me vent fully before she spoke. On this day, she interrupted me. "You want to know something, Diane?" she said. "What?" I answered, surprised that she'd cut in. "You're not your mistakes." Lorraine stared at me for the longest time as that sentence hung in the air between us. I lowered my head, fiddled with my bangle bracelets, and looked up at her again. "Your failures don't define you," she continued. "Your worth isn't about what you do or don't do. You have value simply because you're here." I dropped my eyes to the floor and let that sink in. I'd spent my entire childhood trying to be the good Catholic girl, trying to earn the approval of others, trying not to make the mistakes my brother made, trying to show everyone I wasn't going to be that child, the daughter of immigrants who fell in the ditch. And after all that struggle, I was completely worn out. I didn't have it in me anymore to keep pressing forward. The fact that I'd at last thrown up my hands made me, in my own eyes, a total fuck-up. But in Lorraine's view, it made me a human being, one who deserved to be here, whether or not I did another right thing that day. "Pick yourself up and try again." What a revelation. Our lives try to get our attention in countless ways, through our gut instincts, through our loved ones, through our circumstances, and in my case, through an angel God sent my way exactly at the right juncture. Lorraine showed up in my life when I urgently needed a friend to help me see the truth. She did that, and it was all she could do. Because I'd reached that place we all get to where no amount of compassion or love or hand-holding from someone else can change things, it was on me. As I'd done on that rooftop, I had to close my eyes and make a choice that I wanted better for myself. In November 2009, 1 year after I'd nearly slipped from this world to the next, I made a couple moves. First, I let go of the delusion of a career in law. I then enrolled in an acting course at Boston Casting. And finally, I got headshots taken. Chapter 14. Stage Right. When I sing, trouble can sit right on my shoulder, and I don't even notice. Sarah Vaughan, jazz singer. Much has been written about how to find your passion, your true calling, your career path. As 2010 got underway, I discovered something. You don't choose your life's work. It chooses you. It's this new love that sweeps you up in its momentum, From daybreak to dusk, you can think of nothing else. You find yourself talking faster, louder, more excitedly upon its mention. When I finally gave in to the major pull the performing arts has always had on me, I felt all of the above. I began my mornings by scanning the online industry gossip columns. Who was acting in what? What star had landed a big role in a film or TV series? What trends were popping up in theater? I wanted to see what the industry was looking for. Oh, surprise, surprise. Not me. That was okay, because I was determined to figure out a way for them to get to know me. I searched for any acting classes I could take, and, of course, I eagerly clicked on the classifieds and pored over the audition listings to see if I could walk in somewhere and be discovered on the spot. Hey, a girl can dream. But the reality was much different. I had no idea how to break into this business. None. I couldn't try out for anything because in order to do that, you mainly needed representation by a manager or agent. At first, I kept my mouth shut about my new direction. Brian was aware of it. In fact, he'd been the one to encourage me to sign up for acting classes. He knew it was the one thing that might end my craziness. But I didn't want to discuss my plan with anyone other than him. For a few reasons. First, I thought talking about it might jinx it. I'm a bit superstitious that way. Second, I enjoyed having my own little secret. This thing I could savor in private. And above all, I had zero interest in hearing the unhelpful opinions of others. You've got to be careful who you share your big dreams with. People often piss on them. Some will even talk you out of your aspirations, mostly because they've given up on their own. It's not like I had so many close friends left to shoot the breeze with. But still, I zipped my lips. Plus, I wasn't the type to walk around saying, "I'm an actor and I want to do something special!" I enrolled in two classes, beginning acting and intro to improv. My teacher for both was Peter Burkrot, who was in Caddyshack, a cult classic starring Bill Murray. About 12 of us were in each course, and the students were from all different backgrounds. There was this one lawyer who wanted to improve at litigating by using acting techniques in the courtroom. Another guy just enjoyed being around people and loved the exercises. And there were plenty who, like me, were sticking their toes into the thespian waters for the first time. Yup, a real A-list class. One session was on Mondays, the other on Wednesdays. As the end of each weekend rolled around, I could hardly contain my excitement about taking part in whatever new material we'd cover in the upcoming class. I went from sleeping all day, drinking all night, and not giving a shit about my life, to waking up early in anticipation of all that I could learn. Our passions don't just compel us, they can also heal us. I absolutely loved Peter's courses, and they loved me back. We did a lot of scene work. At the start of improv, for instance, Peter would throw out a scenario. If you've read Amy Poehler's Yes, Please or Tina Fey's Bossy Pants, I'm sure you already know what real improv is. For those who don't know, here's how it went in our class. After Peter had set up the storyline, each of us then had to step into a character and situation and run with it. It was liberating to be so spontaneous and to say yes! Yes to myself, yes to life. It was so much fun. It all just poured out of me. I started to feel like myself again, happy. For most of my life, I'd been a very happy person. And to be in a space where I wasn't, and for such a long period of time, it was driving me nuts. I needed this, an artistic outlet. And Peter was great. He made me feel like I belonged there. In fact, Peter's feedback is what kept me going. Once class was over, I'd often stick around to talk with him, just so I could pick up any few extra tips he might have. "You know, you're good, Diane," he once told me. "You'll have to keep working hard at this, but you do have something." I was already singing my rendition of Some People, the Bernadette Peters version, of course, from the musical Gypsy. Peter also urged me to be less shy. I wasn't always aware of it, but I am a shy person, and believe it or not, that was a revelation to me. It still continues to shock me. To this day, for instance, I'm a socially awkward person who feels weird about hugging. I still have a problem determining if a situation requires a hug or a handshake. I usually end up doing a weird mix of both, which makes people really uncomfortable. Who would have known? This indecisiveness and insecurity would show up in my work. Forget about looking silly, Peter often told me. You've got to get over your inhibitions so you can fully embody the character. I enjoyed class so much, and as I started to dream again, I began to actually call myself an actor. Not out loud, of course. Too soon. But in my head. Chill, D. Although I'd mentally moved on from the whole law thing, I held on to my job at the firm. The longer I stayed, the surer I became that I made the right choice to set aside law school. Most of the attorneys in my office were happy doing what they loved, but that wasn't my gig. I can't stay still for too long, or I will turn into stone, melt, or explode. Not sure if this is 100% true, but I didn't want to chance it. My job there might not have been exactly inspiring to me personally. I was answering phones and taking messages all day. But what I earned did pay for my acting courses. And although I missed all the cash from my cocktail waitressing days, I was thrilled that I moved on from that. I needed a little break. That job really had drained me. I also got fired, but that's neither here nor there. I knew of many girls who worked in that kind of environment for years. That's not going to be me, I think. It's not a bad thing. Some waitresses make a very nice living. But I couldn't handle the constant drinking, the partying, the staying up all night, the entire seedy world. It had carried me down the wrong road. But then, as usual, real life hit and I realized, oh shit, I need money. I had to earn a second check so I could get the creditors off my ass and pay for acting classes. So, I took another nightclub bartending job. Okay, at least I wasn't out on the floor. I ended up working behind the bar. And I did love that the job came with a flexible schedule. Because work was at night, I was free during the day to potentially audition. I knew I had to stay available. I was so determined to get even just a foot in the door that I wasn't about to miss an opportunity. If a casting agent asks, "When can you come in?" I'd go, "Today at 2 is perfect." At this point, most of my auditions were straight off Craigslist, as well as whatever Boston Casting would send me. And you can imagine what kinds of roles were advertised. Some involved no acting at all, but even those were a chance to get on camera. And you name it, I went after it. I once answered an ad for a foot model. Not that I thought my feet were cute, but like I said, I went for everything. When I showed up on set, the director asked if I felt comfortable being topless. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm here for a foot audition? I had no interest in going down the Playboy Bunny road. Oh, and I also tried out for countless no-budget short films and music videos. Most were produced by students who were completing their senior projects, and few involved pay. I was cool with that because just getting something onto my resume was its own kind of payment. One of my first parts was in a music video called Faces, with a Boston R&B singer, Louie Bello. When I look at the video now, it cracks me up and it makes me cringe. All the way through it, Louie and I are basically staring at each other with bedroom eyes. It was all about me trying to look pretty. I was appreciative for the opportunity, but I didn't feel comfortable being the pretty face. I wanted to fight monsters and solve mysteries instead. But hey, it got me on camera. I had to put myself out there somehow. I was working at it constantly. There wasn't a second of the day when I wasn't thinking about the moves I could make to get closer and closer to my dream. Things seemed slow, but I was just taking in the journey. I was giving myself the space to really try something and either succeed or fail at it. At least, I wouldn't die knowing that I didn't make an attempt. I had no illusions of grandeur. I just wanted to throw my hat in the ring. With every part I took, even if I had only a couple of lines, I pushed myself to make the experience smoother than the last. I agreed to be in a 20-minute short, a horror indie flick produced by my friend Billy Dufresne, who was excited just to be making movies. Honestly, the film was wacky, and we did all of our shooting in Billy's backyard. I played a girl who'd gotten locked in a basement by some drug dealers. For most of the filming, I waved my arms wildly and grunted and groaned with duct tape over my mouth. As ridiculous as it was, I was doing it. I was in a project and I was acting. I was also healing and learning even as I was experimenting. There was no time to be sad or discontent with life and no room to judge myself in the process. I wanted something and I was going for it. In the beginning, all my parts were non-union, which meant I wasn't even put in a room with other members of the Screen Actors Guild, SAG, the gold standard membership for actors. You have to work a number of union jobs in order to earn your membership. Starting around June 2010, I got strategic in my search for union jobs. Many actors build up their credits by working as extras in big films. I tried that approach. I eventually scored a job as an extra in the film The Zookeeper, the romantic comedy starring Kevin James from The King of Queens. A big movie with A-list actors on a real set. Whoa. I was doing this thing. Or was I? Because, long story short, it was pure torture. I was one of a slew of extras dressed to appear at this big party in the movie. My time on set started out cool. I got to see, but not personally meet, Kevin James, who was hilarious and phenomenal in his role. Things went downhill from there. All the other nameless, faceless masses and I stood around in our heels and cocktail dresses, holding glasses of champagne that were really filled with apple juice. Every hour or so, the director will yell, "Action!" And the group of us would walk across the room and pretend we were enjoying the shindig. At certain moments, I was supposed to laugh and or cough. It was tedious. I left the set early without even collecting my voucher. I was like, "I'm out of here. Peace out. I'm not doing this. Are you kidding, boo? I am an artiste. I did not, repeat, not want to be in the background." Don't get me wrong. It's a fabulous gig for some actors, and you can make decent money at it. But I had a much different vision for myself. I knew I had a long way to travel before I got to my goal, but this gig made me crystal clear on the final destination I had in mind. I wanted to be an actor who could continue refining my craft by working in the front, not the back. From then on, I decided I'd concentrate on getting whatever work I could get, as long as it required me to use all of my skills. The SAG membership would come one way or the other. As my fervor for my work increased, the depression fell away. I continued to see Lorraine, who nudged me toward more changes and set me up with tools for staying on track. Perfect example. She suggested I use affirmations as anchors. When the doubts in my head cranked up, when my insecurities popped to the surface, I'd reach for one of the phrases Lorraine had taught me to repeat. "I am an intelligent woman. I am a good person and a loving daughter. I matter. And what I have to offer also matters. I can forgive myself for whatever I did yesterday, because today is a new day. Think you is smart, you is kind, you is important." Truth? It initially sounded like hokey cycle babble to me. It felt weird to say these things out loud to myself, but I got over that, and in time, the practice helped me. And to this day, I count myself lucky that I got out of that hole without medication. Praise Jesus! Hallelujah, mi Dios! Many need antidepressants, and there's no shame in that, none. You do what you've got to do. But in my case, the sessions with Lorraine and my return to the arts pulled me back from the brink. I also cut back on the benders. I had become quite a lush. And there's another piece of good fortune I'm grateful for. I didn't have to check myself into rehab in order to lower the bottle. I still partied from time to time, but at least I finally knew what I wanted to do with my life. My classmates became my new circle of friends, In addition to my courses, I signed up for private lessons with Peter. From time to time, he'd take me and his other students to this church space he rented. He'd then pair us for scene work. That's how I met Dave and Kat. They were actors on similar journeys.
I'm telling you, Diane, you could really get out there and do this, Dave would often tell me. The cream always rises to the top.
I loved that saying by my sweet friend Dave.
I'd be like, me? Really?
What are you talking about? I mean, secretly I hoped he was right, but either way, his sweetness boosted me. And Kat was always keeping an eye out for me around the industry. She's the one who'd gotten me the gig in The Zookeeper. By the summer of 2010, the three of us had become inseparable. My confidence gradually improved, and Peter recommended that I have better headshots taken. Boston Casting was hosting a photo clinic, and I signed right up. The pictures were decent, good enough for me to begin submitting them around town. In Boston, there aren't dozens of agents and agencies like there are in New York. There's the main agency, Boston Casting, as well as Carolyn Pickman Casting, also known as CP Casting, and Maggie Inc., a modeling agency. I uploaded my headshot and CV on every site that I could. For weeks, I received not even a nibble. But in the fall of 2010, I got my first official audition, meaning one I hadn't scrounged up for myself on Craigslist. In other words, it was legit. It was a part on a Kmart commercial.
Oh my God, I can't believe it, I shrieked when I told Brian the news.
You would have thought I had just won $1 million on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And as far as I was concerned, this was the much bigger prize.
I'm so excited!
This means they looked at my headshots and liked them. You get pretty mind-fucked in this industry. Sometimes a bite of anything brings your hopes to an all-time high, only to have them drop the next day. Making it as an actor is easier said than done. But you have to keep perspective and stay level-headed. Optimistic, but not overly excited.
Ah, you'll figure it out, is what I often tell myself. Just do the work and you'll be fine.
On the morning of the tryout, my enthusiasm gave way to terror.
What should I wear? What should I say? Will they like me?
I had no clue how any of it was supposed to go, and it scared the hell out of me. I'd been given 3 lines. I'd memorized them so thoroughly I could have repeated them in my sleep. One was something cheesy like this.
These cotton t-shirts are incredible, and only $9.99.
I'd prepared it as if I was making my debut appearance in the year's hottest biopic. Believe me, I took this all quite seriously. I made my way into the studio. The waiting room overflowed with all sorts of folk, some brown-haired and lanky, others thick, short, burly. I didn't know who was there for what, and yet I still did what many actors do. I sized up the competition. There were definitely some pretty girls, but I was one of the only couple of Latinas. Who knew? Maybe that'd be the look they went for. One at a time, the actors were called in. The casting director, a goth woman with straight-edge bangs and a clipboard, at last said my name. Diane, she called.
Yes,
I said, sitting up and straightening the simple tee and jeans I so'd carefully chosen.
Come right on in, she said.
I followed her into the room. There, a couple of casting directors sat in a semicircle. No one cracked a smile. The goth lady explained the concept of the commercial and handed me a prop. A pink tee to be featured in the ad.
Do you want to give us your first line? She asked.
Sure, I said. I cleared my throat and stood up tall.
These cotton t-shirts are incredible,
I said with as much zest as I could while holding up the t-shirt. I had the most stupid grin plastered on my face. The group sat silent.
Okay, great, the goth woman finally said. Let's hear your other 2 lines.
I delivered both flawlessly, and again the director stared blankly at me.
That'll be all, the main woman told me.
Thank you for coming in. She then followed me into the lobby and called in her next victim. 3 days later, my big break became my heartbreak. I didn't get the part. I tried not to let it sour my mood, but it did sting. The fact that I'd invested so much effort made it feel like even more of a letdown. You never know what they're looking for, Peter told me. It could have been something as random as they didn't think you were the right height, or they decided to use a man instead. You just have to keep going out on as many calls as you can. It took me a month to recover from the disappointment, but once I did, I followed Peter's advice and got back up. Through Dave, I connected with Rebecca Royer, who was then an undergraduate film student at Harvard. She was auditioning a bunch of people for the principal role in a short called Ashley Amber. You should try out, Dave urged. I don't think I'm ready for that, I told him. I checked out some of Rebecca's other work online and let myself get intimidated. Her stuff was good. Diane, you're totally ready, Dave goaded. Just do it. Another reason for my apprehension, the script contained the scene in which the main character has sex with her boyfriend and the dude dies. I was like, I don't want to do an indie film making love with someone who croaks. Or making love on a film at all, for that matter. But Dave was like, dude, you can sort that out later. Go in and see what happens. On the day of the tryout, it snowed. The audition was on Harvard's campus. The fact alone was nerve-wracking. Dave came along. This is awful, I told him as we cut across the icy Harvard yard. It's a mess out here. I wish I'd never signed up for this. I don't even know what I'm doing here. As we walked, my mind flashed back to all those Sundays when Papi drove us through Wellesley. The look of the Cambridge campus, with all its ivy-covered buildings and gold steeples, reminded me of that community. It was a secret elite world I never thought I'd get to be a part of, and yet here I was. And it freaked me out. Calm down, Dave told me. Remember, the cream always rises to the top. Rebecca called me in almost right away. How are you, Diane? She asked, extending her hand. She seemed as nice as they come. Phew. I'm great, I said. Dave shot me a thumbs up as we went off into a small studio. Literally, 10 minutes later, it was over. Just as I was preparing to rejoin Dave in the waiting area and delight him with another round of, poor me, Rebecca surprised me. I appreciate you coming in today, she said. And it'd be great if you could come back. What? Did I hear her correctly? Is this a callback before I even left the building? All right, I said shyly. How about next Wednesday, she asked. Yeah, sure, I answered. O-M-G. When I returned for the callback, I took one look around the waiting room and nearly crapped my pants. To my right sat an insanely gorgeous blonde with plump lips and perfect teeth. On my left was a brunette who was almost as much of a knockout. I'm so not getting this. We all looked so different that I started wondering how we could all be up for the same role. Maybe she's auditioning for multiple parts, I thought. Fingers crossed, 'cause I have no shot in hell against Angelina Jolie over here. When Rebecca brought me in a few minutes later, I went in there and did my thing. I held nothing back. Wait here, she told me afterward. She disappeared from the room and returned wearing a big smile. I'd love to offer you the part, she said. The room stood still. Really? I squealed. You would? Yes, I would, she said. I think you would be a perfect fit. I was stunned. Literally. I'm so glad Dave connected us, she continued as I stood there looking befuddled. I'd already auditioned 100 girls for the part and I couldn't find the right person. I left that room and called Dave on his cell. She wants me, I screamed. Thank you so much for pushing me to do this. It blew me away that I'd been picked out of so many girls. To say I was amazed is the understatement of the millennium. At last, after so many setbacks and failures in the previous few years, I was getting something right. Working on the film is still on my top 10 list of most fun experiences. First of all, this film had a budget. No, I didn't get paid, but all my meals were provided. And stop the presses! I was the main character. Not to mention, I was getting 23 minutes of me. I could also get a reel out of this. In the film, which is a dark comedy, Ashley and Amber are the same person. During filming, everyone in the cast had to pitch in. That's the way it goes with a low budget. And the set? For the set, we shot at Rebecca's co-op, at a cafe, and sometimes even inside my apartment. We also did a lot of outside shots in the snow. The whole thing was very crunchy granola. Artsy. I got such a rush whenever I was on camera. Most of the time, I didn't know what I was doing, but I took the fake it till you make it approach. I was so serious. Probably because I was fresh and nervous. I wanted everything to be perfect, by the book. I didn't do what a lot of actors call playing, where you try different things and really make the material your own. When you're feeling free, when you have a handle on who you are, you're more able to go in there and try new things. I hadn't yet grown to that place. The fear of failure stopped me from letting down my hair, and when I look back at the film now, I can see that my performance reflected that. But Rebecca was happy. "You gave me what I wanted from you," she'd tell me. And I guess she was onto something. The film was later chosen to be screened at the Berlin International Film Festival, and I got to travel to Germany with the cast and see the big premiere. And yes, the flashback sex scene ended up in the film. Hashtag awkward. My life was shifting for the good, yet I still wasn't calling my family all that regularly. When I did reach Puppy, he seemed proud of me. "I've always known you were meant for this," he'd tell me. "Remember how you used to sing all the time at the dinner table?" I won't lie, it was still difficult for me to even be on the phone with Puppy. But I was making progress, and the more we did talk, the better we both felt. Funny how confronting your fears will do that for you. Go figure. As for Mommy, I really didn't get to connect with her at all during this time, or know how things were going in Spain. Although I had a couple of credits to my name, I remained tight-lipped about my acting. For instance, I never invited the other girls at the bar to watch any of the films I was in. I did test the waters once by mentioning to a coworker that I was experimenting with acting. "So what are you going to do?" she said. "Be in porn?" Whew. That hurt. And it reaffirmed my choice to shut up about everything. In 2011, my cover was blown. Earlier that year, an amazing opportunity arose, one that was pretty rare in Boston. I got an audition for the ABC series Body of Proof. For the audition, I had to simulate driving and falling asleep at the wheel. When the character awakens, she realizes she's run over someone and is later arrested. By this time, I wasn't a complete neurotic freak during auditions. I was becoming more comfortable. The same day I did the audition, the unimaginable happened. I got the part! Do you know how that felt for me? It was like I'd been told I was a series regular. A couple of weeks later, we traveled to Rhode Island to shoot the scene, the same one I'd auditioned with. I've arrived! My first union credit. I wasn't just an actor. I was a traveling actor. I had a trailer and everything, complete with a hair and makeup team. I felt like I'd arrived. Weeks later, without knowing it, the episode aired. My scene was the show's opener. You know how on Law & Order they always have the first scene before the show really comes on? That's how it was for Body of Proof. So I was front and center. I started getting these emails from people in Colombia. I was also getting tons of messages on Facebook. "I just saw you on TV," Dana wrote. I couldn't believe it. I recorded it on DVR and watched it a gazillion times. It felt wonderful. All I could think was, that's me! That's really me! In retrospect, I'm still amazed at everything that happened during that short period. I did a 360. Many times in our sessions, Lorraine would ask me, how does it feel to be in front of the camera? I feel free, I told her. Like I can do anything. Not that performing isn't the scariest thing ever, but the fear is part of the exhilaration. And when you're in it, feeling that rush, it's just bliss. I'd had that rush in high school when I'd performed at Springfest, and then again during my senior recital. The difference between me back then and me at this point is that I'd grown up. I had material to draw from. The journey I'd taken. Even the most heart-wrenching parts began to shape me as an artist and as a person. And as I let go of some of the judgments I had about my past, I also became less critical of my own work. When you put something out there, it's not about deciding whether it's good or bad. It's about creating it, and then letting it go with the hope that others take some light or inspiration from it. After the big high of the TV appearance, I began considering my next move. Brian's and my relationship was stable. But by this point, we both knew it had run its course. We'd become more like roommates than romantic partners, and whether or not I stayed in Boston, it was time for us to part. Life was clearly moving me toward a career on the stage, and in order to explore that, I needed to be willing to step out. The place to do that was in the mecca of the acting world, New York City. As they say, if you can make it in the Big Apple, you can make it anywhere, honey. I wanted to prove to myself and the world that I had what it took to do this thing. There are years that ask questions and years that answer, Zora Neale Hurston once wrote. The year 2009 was the one that asked me why I was here. The years 2010 and 2011 gave their answer. Chapter 15, New York City. It is not true that people stop pursuing dreams because they grow old. They grow old because they stop pursuing dreams. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Colombian novelist and recipient of the 1982 Nobel Prize in Literature. How's everyone feeling? Mariska, a coach at the Susan Batson Studio near Manhattan's Times Square, scanned the row of faces. Eight others and I had gathered for our bi-weekly therapy session, acting course, one called Exer Actor. The course included several components, including awareness and emotional flexibility. Mariska, this whip-smart, fiery, and soulful woman, nodded toward the first person in our semicircle. That was Ethan, a Brooklyn guy with wild, wiry black curls springing from his head. Ethan, what are you aware of today?
I'm aware that I missed my train on the way here, and I almost didn't make it, he said, sighing. So, to be honest, I'm aware that I'm feeling fucking out of breath right now.
A few of us snickered. Mariska smiled approvingly and shifted her gaze to the next person in line, me. Diane, what are you aware of? She asked. I glanced around at my classmates before I rested my gaze on Mariska.
I guess I'm aware that I'm jittery today, I said, twirling the bottom lock of my hair. My mom left me this insane long voicemail this morning, and, well, to be honest, I feel like a terrible daughter.
Some people laughed, but I wasn't being funny. Maybe I'd been very Kramer in my delivery. Mariska made her way around the others. One girl had lost her beloved cat and was overcome with grief. An older dude, a retired dentist, was aware of his exhilaration after hearing he'd gotten a part in a commercial. He was also aware that he had to be kinder to himself. And a red-headed woman, a mother from Queens, said
She was aware that she was feeling neutral and didn't really feel like sharing. After everyone had gotten a turn, we moved on to part two of our class, the musical interlude, a.k.a. emotional flexibility. Mariska walked over to the stereo and put on Stevie Wonder's Superstition. It was so loud it practically shook the walls. "Up on your feet, you guys," she shouted over the music. We all stood and formed a large full circle around the classroom space and stretched a little in preparation for what we knew was coming. "Don't judge yourself. This is a safe space," she yelled out. "Ethan, you go first." Without any sign of hesitation, Ethan strutted into the middle and began flinging his arms and legs all over the place while snapping his fingers to the beat of his heart, or whatever else he might have been hearing in his head. There was no right or wrong way. The exercise was about allowing us to connect emotionally and intellectually to our bodies so that we wouldn't be freaking robots. It was a way of getting loose for the work ahead. "Okay, Diane," Mariska called out a moment later. "Now you." Reluctantly, I slid into the middle of everyone and moved lamely along to the music. At first, I was nervous and completely judging myself, but after a few seconds, I got into it and let the music's rhythm carry me as best I could. Each of us took a turn, with Mariska shouting out directives from the side of the room. "Be present to your bodily sensations," she told us. "Give in to yourself. Let go of your shit, Diane. Don't resist. Drop your judgments about what it looks like. Let yourselves be free." Freedom of emotional expression. Our coursework revolved around that principle. Why? Because great acting, as Mariska often reminded us, involves more than simply learning techniques. It's also about getting so comfortable with your own feelings that you can empathize with those of the characters you portray. In class, for instance, we did a lot of what's called sense memory work, which is letting sensory conditions along with the needs of a character affect the physical and emotional life of that character. "Think about that time in your childhood when you were most vulnerable," Mariska once told us. "Oh, my Lord," I sat there thinking. "Close your eyes and imagine that you're back in that very moment. Notice how your body feels. What can you see? Can you smell anything?" By the end of it, some were in tears. Others, like me, twisted in their seats. A few sat stunned. It was intense. The point was for you to find your truth as well as the truth in every character you played. The founder of the studio, Susan Batson, who'd coached greats like Nicole Kidman, wrote a book on the topic. It's called Truth. And it was required reading in our course. Like I said, therapy. Susan Batson was my first stop in New York in August 2011. Elizabeth, a friend of mine from Boston who'd already moved to the city to break into the biz, told me to check it out. At the time, Elizabeth was working for a well-known talent manager, this old Italian lady. She also suggested I go and meet with the manager of the studio to do a short audition. I did. And it was a complete disaster. "Diane, is that Guo Weiwei?" she asked, squinting her forehead as she peered down over the top edge of her reading glasses at the sign-in sheet. "How do you pronounce your last name?" she asked in one of the thickest Brooklyn accents I've ever heard. I'm talking deep Bensonhurst thick. "It's Guerrero," I said, trying to keep up a fake smile. "Well, whatever," she said, setting aside the sheet and picking up another. "Here's some dialogue for you to read to me. Have a quick look and then shoot." I looked up and down the paper, which contained a few short lines at the top. I stood up straight, lifted the sheet to my face, and delivered the lines as smoothly as I could. "Please, brain, don't do that thing where you jumble up all the letters and I sound like I'm from another country," I thought. She stared at me without batting an eyelash.
"Okay," she said. "The thing is, honey, I don't know if you're pretty enough for this business."
I could feel the steam coming out of my ears.
"But yeah, I guess we'll give you a try, only because you're Elizabeth's friend."
"All right," I said. "Thanks for the vote of confidence, you witch."
"That sounds good. Do you have any headshots?" she asked.
I reached down into my bag and pulled out a folder filled with photos and handed it to her. She flipped through the packet, barely pausing to look at each pose.
"It looks like you'll need some new pictures," she told me.
I guess mine were too Boston for her.
"But you're in luck. I know a guy who can do them for you. He's a bit pricey, but he's good. I also suggest you sign yourself up for Susan Batson. Elizabeth probably already told you that."
I nodded. How much are the photos?
"You'll have to call him to get an exact price, honey," she told me. "But I think they're around $1,200."
I nearly pissed my underwear.
$1,200? I asked.
"Yep," she told me, handing the photos back to me.
"But trust me, he's worth every dime. He can make anyone look like $1,000,000, even you."
Right then, I wished I knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy, if you know what I mean. I'd walked in that morning with the hope of landing a teammate and a cheerleader. I left with a snarky Brooklynite on board and a mandate to round up some serious cash, pronto, and a brand new set of heart palpitations. At this point, I didn't even yet have a permanent home in New York. The only way I'd been able to afford the courses was to keep my steady bar job in Boston. That's right. Twice a week, I was schlepping from there to the city via Greyhound, 4 hours each direction. Once in the area, I stayed with my Aunt Millie in Passaic, New Jersey, in a corner of my cousin's bedroom. The commute was a total nightmare. It had also turned me into a bag lady. Most of the time, I walked around with this enormous duffel strapped across my body. Not a good look. Whenever I came into the city, I took classes and occasionally auditioned. When you're just starting out, you're lucky to get in the room. It's true that as a girl, I'd imagined one day getting into musical theater, but at this point, acting had become my sole focus. And when I look back on those years when I bopped around the house, belting out Selena hits, I didn't do so with the thought that I'd become a famous pop singer. For me, the fantasy was more about being on stage, connecting with an audience, telling a story, basking in the spotlight. The first time I stepped off the Greyhound in Manhattan, I felt born to be here. The place pulsates with this insane energy. It's unpredictable. It's gritty. It's real. It's dangerous. The folks who gravitate to New York, people with dreams bigger than the sky, are my kind of peeps. There's a certain electricity in the air here, one created in part by the fierce competition. The stakes are high, the skyscrapers even higher. And you've gotta be a badass to even stay on the ball field. That's true not only in my biz, but in every industry. Even a bum here has to be on double hustle. First of all, it can get cold as hell in this town. Second of all, there's always someone ready to elbow you out of the way. Not to mention that everything happens in a big, fat hurry. So no one has time to stop and hear your sob story. The pace and the pressure can be tough, yet that's exactly what keeps you working your tail off. In the city that never sleeps, I quickly learned I'd better not either. The audition process was 3 times more brutal than it had been in Boston. I thought I'd seen my share of gorgeous girls. Here, they literally filled the tryout waiting rooms, standing around with their perfect tits, teeth, and booties, and money and connections. Talent and good looks are as prevalent here as nepotism is. To make it, you've got to be damn good at what you do or know someone who can help you get to the front of the line. In many cases, you need both. I'd turn up to these auditions and absolutely give it my all. I'd then wait by the phone for days and hear nothing. No callbacks. No nothing. Which is how I realized if I was really going to do this thing, I needed to relocate to the city. Full time. So after 3 months of schlepping, I at last traded in my Boston bar job for another in Midtown Manhattan. I also cut ties with Brian. We were sad about it, but knew it was for the best. "Can I please have the room in the basement?" I asked my Aunt Millie. She'd long since noticed how the commute was wearing me out, and she graciously agreed. It was a tight space with only enough room for a twin bed, a TV, and a dresser, but it was a place to stay. And I was grateful she wasn't charging me rent. Being there also meant I could hang with my family. When I dragged home late in the evenings, my aunt would often be up waiting to offer me my favorite dish, rice, beans, and plantains with a side of lime or lemon to squirt all over it. So sweet. Young, aspiring actors have often asked me whether I ever wanted to quit. Yes, sometimes daily. But like it or not, and I do like it, I rolled up in this world as an artist. It's who I am. The alternative to continuing in my struggle was returning to the way I felt after I left high school. In my heart of hearts, I knew I'd veered off the career path I was meant to take, and that's in part why I almost ended my life. So as hard as it was to show up to an endless succession of rejections, I stuck with it. When you want something badly, like to the point of near obsession, the work doesn't feel as strenuous. And don't get me wrong, it's exhausting and often heartbreaking. But while you may be physically tired and your spirit is tested, it cannot be drained. If you love it, you will find the juice. The effort actually gives you energy rather than depleting you of it. This business is so challenging that you're constantly trying to beat your existing score, and when you do, oh, how sweet it is. You've got the wind at your back and the force propels you forward. Until it doesn't. Because that same wind can also knock you flat on your ass, which is what seemed to be happening to me after 6 months in the city. I was down to my last $100 and still living with my aunt, with an average of maybe 2 auditions a week. I hadn't landed a role in anything, and I'd spent what savings I did have on those stupid photos the manager recommended. Those types of headshots are totally going out of style, a seasoned actor at the studio told me. That may be one reason you're not getting more callbacks, which, of course, wasn't true, but what did I know? Fuck! I trusted this woman, and there I was with nothing to show for my investment. And as much passion as I'd brought with me to the city, it had become increasingly difficult to keep my head up. I was at least saving the little cheese I made at the bar to pay for my acting classes, but after months of saving, it wasn't enough for me to afford my own place. Not by a long shot. That's when I needed to take my effort to the next level and round up some cash, gangsta style. Let me explain. I was so broke that I went on Craigslist. It had kept me busy before. So while poring over the site one evening, I scanned the ads from people seeking to purchase certain items, which included everything from Rolex watches to washing machines. About halfway down the first page, my eyes landed on this headline. Wanted. Women's used shoes. Secondhand shoes? Who'd want someone else's smelly footwear? Well, some guy in New Jersey did, and according to his CL entry, he was willing to pay up to $30 a pair for them. The more stinky and worn out, the higher the price, he wrote. I hadn't brought much with me from Boston, but I've always been a bit of a shoe fanatic and still owned plenty of pairs. So I wrote to this dude and arranged to meet him at a bar for the exchange. The guy was in his early 20s. He had an artist hipster-type beard. He was wearing a beanie and jeans. I'd imagine he'd be a super creepy dude with an old-school Kiss t-shirt. A guy who hadn't bothered to brush his teeth or hair for days. But instead, I found someone completely different. He looked clean and cool. This doesn't mean I wasn't careful. I mean, I was still nervous and cautious because, after all, I was meeting a random man from Craigslist and selling him my old stinky shoes. The point is that I was desperate. And after a quick and nervous hello, I handed him my bag of old shoes. And one at a time, he took them out and inspected them. The heels were run down on one pair. My moccasins had a huge hole in the toe area. I'd gathered 5 pairs in all. Is this all you've got? He asked. Well, yeah, for now, I said with a shrug. I can give you $110 for all of them. I thought you said $30 a pair. Yeah, but some of these aren't very worn out, he said. I'll pay $20 for the ones in better condition, $30 for the moccasins. Do you want the money or not? It was so sketchy that it felt like a drug transaction. I paused for a second, but only for a brief one. I'll take it, I said. I needed the money no matter how weird the situation. I might be able to bring you more next week, I said. We'll see. Good, he told me. And off we went in opposite directions. I met up with the dude at least 3 more times, and by the last meeting, I realized he was more of a cool guy than a creep. He even gave me some of his artwork, which was pretty good. Apparently, he was selling the shoes to guys all over New Zealand and Australia who had women's foot fetishes. Hey, whatever floats your boat, dude. You take socks? Anyway, all I knew is that I had some cold, hard cash in my pocket. In fact, by the end of it, I collected more than $500 from the guy. Never mind that I'd left myself with two pairs of shoes, black boots for work and a pair of Bobos. I laughed, slash cried at the thought that I could have been murdered and chopped up into little pieces by a Craigslist killer. That move was dangerous, but as I mentioned, I had to go gangsta. I consoled myself with the fantasy of one day telling this story on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.